Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
So, as I mentioned, there's a lockdown coming up in Germany. That's why many people are worried. And it's basically the very old debate that we've been having for like 9 months now, 8 months. It's the same ethical dilemma as anywhere, basically, in the world. You need to protect the economy so people have the means to live versus protect the health of the people so people don't die. Would you say there is any way out of this dilemma?
I think there's no way out of this dilemma as long as the pandemic persists. But I think there are better and worse ways of contending with the dilemma.
What do you mean?
Of striking a sensible balance between lockdowns and enabling the economy to flourish as best it can. And I must say that Germany has done a better job than the United States in striking that balance.
But pretty much everyone has, to be honest. But what would be a sensible balance?
Well, I think Germany's approach, as I've observed it from a distance, looks very good by contrast to what we've experienced here. We've experienced really from the federal government and from Trump a neglect, a failure to plan, a failure to take the pandemic seriously and to combat it in a coordinated way. And so various states have taken initiatives that have been effective, others less so. But we've had a very inconsistent response, and this accounts for our failure, really, to contain the virus or to limit the number of hospitalizations and deaths. I think Germany, certainly South Korea, have had much stronger responses, which is to say more serious targeted lockdowns to try to keep the infection rate down while easing up where possible to enable economic activity to go forward.
So you would say it's sensible to protect the economy so people have the means to live as well?
Yes, but the only practical way to protect the economy is to contain the virus. That's the problem we've seen here in the United States, and that's been our failure. We've seen it as too stark a contrast between the economy or health. What our president has failed to recognize is that the only way to open the economy and to make it possible to open schools safely is to take other measures, including mask wearing mandates and other selective lockdowns, to enable us to contain the virus well enough to allow economic activity to go forward and to enable students to attend schools.
Mr. Sandel, you have worked extensively on the topic of justice, and I would like to focus on that when we look at the corona pandemic. Is that pandemic not only unfair, but unfair twice or in a double way, or in the sense that it doesn't only hurt people very differently depending on the situation, but it will also deepen the divide and worsen the inequalities even more in the future? So is it twice unfair?
Yes. In the first instance, the pandemic, like most crises, reveals divisions in society that pre-exist the pandemic. And it's important to remember that the pandemic arrived at a time when we were not only medically unprepared for it, but also morally unprepared. It arrived at a time of deep division and polarization that resulted in part from the deepening inequalities of recent decades. Early on in the pandemic, we often heard the slogan, "We are all in this together," which was true in the sense that we are all vulnerable to the virus, but it was not true in the sense that we didn't really experience the pandemic equally. Those of us who have the luxury of working from home, from our homes, are in a very different situation from those workers who, in order to make a living, have to expose themselves to risk to their health, and in some cases, to their lives. So the pandemic revealed, but I think also exacerbated, the deep inequalities that have arisen in our society in recent decades. And we see this in the organization of work, the distinction, the division between those who can work remotely and those who must work at risk, exposed.
The pandemic is also the dominant topic in the U.S. election, the upcoming election. There are only a few days left to vote for people. Are you personally worried that this will not be a normal election night and that a peaceful transfer of power in case Biden wins is not going to happen?
President Trump has threatened repeatedly not to accept the results of the election. And he has prepared to declare that any result that goes against him can only be the result of voter fraud. He said this again and again. And I suspect he will say it on election night if he loses and in the days and weeks thereafter. But I think it's important to know that much of what Trump says is bluster and should not be taken too seriously. And so I predict that there will be a lot of bluster and complaint and complaints of fraud, but that in the end, he will leave. There will be a peaceful transfer of power. I think it's important to separate the threats and the bluster that Donald Trump constantly makes and what he actually does. So I hope and expect that if he is defeated, that there will be a peaceful transfer of power.
One aspect of that is that Trump is being seen as someone or portrays himself as someone who is anti-elitist. That's what he ran on 4 years ago. And his victory 4 years ago has been interpreted as this antipathy towards the established elites in Washington. But Trump himself, funnily, is a very established man, a somewhat wealthy man, a privileged man. Do you think this anti-elitist momentum wore off and now lost its charm?
I don't think that the anti-elitist political sentiment has disappeared. I think that Trump has lost some popularity, not because of that, but because of his utter failure to govern, and in particular to deal with the pandemic. I think that's the reason for his loss of popularity by comparison with 2016. But I think the anti-elitist sentiment that he tapped into, the anger against governing elites, credentialed elites, meritocratic elites, I don't think that that has disappeared. And I think that the Democratic Party and the mainstream politicians from both parties need to figure out what that anger is about. There are some, it seems to me, there are some legitimate grievances embedded in the populist backlash against elites that the mainstream parties have to figure out if they're to govern effectively even after Trump.
And in your book, you do exactly that. You argue that the Democrats have established something that you call a success ethic that has turned some of their voters against them. Could you maybe elaborate on that and explain why we have seen this protest against this ideal of individual success only in the recent years?
Yes, the success ethic, the rhetoric of rising. This has been the offer, the political project of the Democratic Party and of center-left parties generally in Europe, it seems to me, in recent decades. The response to the deepening inequality of recent decades has been, for the most part, not to deal with that inequality directly, but instead to make the following offer. If you want to compete and win in the global economy, go to university. Then you too may be able to rise. But the rhetoric of rising, the promise that people, if they get a good degree, can rise as far as their talents will take them. This success ethic, this rhetoric of rising, by 2016, had lost its capacity to inspire, partly because it's not easy to rise. Upward mobility is relatively rare. More than this, it's an inadequate response to the wage stagnation, to the job losses, and also to the loss of esteem accorded a great many workers. This, I think, underlies the anger, the resentment against elites, especially professional elites, credentialed elites. And so I think we need to change the terms of public discourse in order to focus less on arming people for meritocratic competition and more on affirming and renewing the dignity of work, credentialed or otherwise.
You just criticized the rhetoric of rising, as you say, but most people probably intuitively would say rising is something empowering, inspiring, and it has enabled a lot of people to climb up the social ladder. So this whole idea of the meritocracy, as you say, is better than most other options we have, for example, nepotism, isn't it?
Yes, there is something inspiring about the rhetoric of rising and about the promise of individual upward mobility through the exercise of one's talents. Merit is a good thing. If I need to have surgery performed, I certainly want a well-qualified doctor. So my criticism is not of merit as such, but my criticism is If I need surgery, I want a well-qualified surgeon to perform it. So merit is a good thing. The problem is that as a political response to inequality, the inequality brought about by four decades of neoliberal globalization, meritocracy is an inadequate solution. It tells people that if chances are equal, then those who land on top, those who succeed, deserve their success and can consider their success their own doing. In recent decades, the divide between winners and losers has been deepening, poisoning our politics, driving us apart. This is not only about the growing inequality of income and wealth. It's also about changing attitudes towards success. Those who have landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit, and that those who struggle, those left behind, must have no one to blame but themselves. And so this aspect of meritocracy, these attitudes towards success, generate hubris among the winners, and humiliation among those left behind. And this, I think, is what's prepared the way for the angry populist backlash against meritocratic elites. It's the dark side of meritocracy. And the dark side of meritocracy is that ultimately, by generating this hubris and humiliation, it's corrosive of the common good. It's corrosive of a sense of solidarity that we are all in this together.
I would like to stay on this aspect of the dark side of meritocracy that you just mentioned, because I'm wondering if that, what you describe, is mainly the American dream. And we see now that the American dream basically is a bubble that is bursting, or if you want to phrase it differently, it turns out to be a very dangerous ideology. And ideology might be like bad breath. Always other people have bad breath, in your opinion. But now the U.S. realizes, oh, damn, we have bad breath. And it's all over society. So isn't it maybe a very American problem that this society has been built on the ideology of the American dream, and now it finds out it's not working anymore?
I think it's only partly, maybe most vividly, an American problem. I think it's a challenge, the undue reliance on meritocracy, the changing attitudes toward winning and losing. I think it may be perhaps visible, especially visible in America, but not only here. You'll tell me whether you think this applies to Germany and to Europe or not. It's true that traditionally, Americans have told themselves, we've told ourselves a comforting story about inequality. We've said, we don't need to worry so much about inequalities of income and wealth. In Europe, they worry about inequality. But here in America, there's the chance for mobility, upward mobility. And that's an alternative to worrying about inequality. Here in America, children are not consigned to the class of their birth. They can rise. Now, this idea that mobility is an alternative to equality is a comforting story that no longer fits the facts. Because intergenerational mobility, being born poor and rising as an adult to affluence or even the middle class, that is not easy to do in the U.S. In fact, the rates of upward mobility in the U.S. now are less than the rates in Germany and many European countries and in Canada. So we can no longer tell ourselves that we can be indifferent to the problem of inequality because there is always the chance for individual upward mobility. But I think this isn't only an American problem, an American loss of illusion, perhaps, because I think the inequalities, but also the changing attitudes towards success, the tendency of the successful to inhale too deeply of their success, I think this is a broader phenomenon. And I think the anger against governing elites in the aftermath of four decades of globalization, I think this anger is something that we see fueling protest movements and political movements in Europe as well as in the United States. And so I think it's a broader phenomenon, this disillusion with the idea that meritocratic upward mobility, the rhetoric of rising, can be a substitute for serious efforts to contend with the inequalities that recent economic policies have produced.
I would like to stay for one second on the idea of the individual, because I feel like one problem of merit is that it's based on the notion of the individual capability, as you also described it. The individual is seen as something that is autonomous, that is not dependent on others, has not been shaped by the structure surrounding it, so it's not aware of its own privileges, for example. Do you think that now there might be a shift in the way that we understand and conceptualize human beings, and that maybe even movements like the Black Lives Matter movement challenge this whole notion of merit, but also of the idea how we conceive human beings?
Yes, and I think the Black Lives Matter movement is one of the most hopeful signs in a rather bleak civic picture today. It has become a multi-generational, multi-racial movement, social movement, political movement that has had a genuine impact, and I think could be an opening for a broader public debate about what makes for a just society, about what we owe one another as citizens, about what it means to seek after the common good. So I see this as a very hopeful sign. During the pandemic, there has been another opening for a new debate, a broader debate about the common good, and that's the recognition that those of us who do have the luxury of working from home, we can't help but notice how deeply we rely on workers we often overlook. I'm thinking not only of those heroic workers in the hospitals caring for COVID patients, but I'm thinking also of delivery workers, warehouse workers, grocery store clerks, truckers, home health care providers, nurse assistants. These are not the best paid or the most honored workers in our society. And yet now we are recognizing them as essential workers. And so this could be a moment for a broader debate about how to bring their pay and recognition into better alignment with the importance of the work they do. More than that, it's a moment that can remind us that the money people make is not the measure of their contribution to the common good. We tend to assume that it is, but this is a mistake. We can think of lots of cases where the labor market is a very poor indicator of what really matters most by way of the contribution that various workers make. So part of the broader debate we need, I think, is a debate about what really counts as a contribution to the common good. We've outsourced that moral judgment to markets in recent decades. I think we need to reclaim it for debate by all of us as democratic citizens.
And does that also mean, coming back to the notion of what it means to be human, that we get a new perspective on how we conceptualize human beings, not as autonomous, but rather as interconnected beings that are dependent on others, so that the whole idea of being privileged is also becomes transparent, becomes visible, that privilege becomes visible, which is one of the goals of the Black Lives Matter movement, right?
Yes, our tendency has been to assume that we as individuals are self-made and self-sufficient. And this picture of the person reinforces the attitudes towards success that we've been discussing. The tendency to believe that if I succeed, my success is my own doing, the measure of my merit. What this forgets is the role of luck in life. It also forgets my sense of indebtedness to those who helped me on my way, indebtedness to family, teachers, neighborhood, community, country, the times in which we live. So being more aware of the role of luck in life can be an important antidote to the meritocratic hubris that leads us to believe, mistakenly, that our success is our own doing and that we're not indebted neither to luck and fortune nor to those who helped us on our way. So in a way, what I'm arguing for is the notion that we are connected, that we are situated, that we are indebted to one another, and therefore we have responsibilities to one another, however well-credentialed we may be. We are indebted. And so it's really a shift, not only in political argument that I'm suggesting, but also a shift in the way we understand ourselves as persons and as democratic citizens.
When you speak of this shift, does that mean that you generally think that meritocracy has taken over democracy in the Northern Hemisphere to a certain extent? So would you actually say it became the most dominant feature of it?
Yes. And we spoke earlier about the inspiring aspect of meritocracy. We think of it in the first instance as an alternative to nepotism, as an alternative, for that matter, to aristocratic hierarchy, to having one's life fate determined by the accident of birth. Meritocracy seems to offer a chance to be masters of our own fate, not to be victims of circumstance or the accident of our birth. And this does represent an improvement, of course, over aristocratic ideals. But what we're recognizing now, as meritocracy has become such a widespread ideal in Western societies, we are becoming increasingly alive to the dark side. The true alternative to meritocracy is not aristocracy, it's democracy. It's recognizing that whatever success we have is not due only to our own talents and efforts. And for that matter, even what counts as a talent depends on the society in which we live and on the qualities that that society happens to reward and prize. Take a great successful athlete, let's say, Cristiano Ronaldo, makes tens of millions, very successful. But two questions could be asked of his success. Is it really his doing that he has the talents, the gifts to be such a great football player? Or is he indebted for that? Is he lucky to have those talents? And more than that, isn't he lucky to live in a society and at a time when the world loves football? The world loves the sport at which he excels. If he had lived during the Renaissance, they weren't as in love with football back then. They cared more about fresco painters. So, and this is true across the economy. Those of us who have talents that the society rewards need to recognize that we are lucky to have those talents and to live in a society that happens to prize and reward those talents. And with that recognition should come, I think, a greater sense of humility in the face of our talents and a greater sense of responsibility and solidarity for those left less gifted, less fortunate, less lucky than we.
We were discussing the connection of merit and democracy and how merit or the meritocracy took over parts of the democracy in the Northern Hemisphere, at least. Can you maybe describe how merit undermines the sense of solidarity in a society?
Believing that my success is my due makes it hard to see myself in other people's shoes. Appreciating the role of luck in life can prompt a certain humility. It can invite me to reflect there, but for the accident of birth or the grace of God or the mystery of fate, go I. So this spirit of humility, this recognition of the role of luck and good fortune in life can open us to a greater sense of solidarity, a greater concern for the common good, a greater sympathy for and identification with those less fortunate than ourselves. So meritocracy reinforces the tendency for us to consider that everything we make, we've earned for ourselves. Because if chances are equal, if the race is fair, the winners tend to view their winnings as their own, as something they deserve. So this makes solidarity very hard to achieve. Whereas a greater appreciation of the role of luck in life, of indebtedness for one's gifts and talents, can open us, I think, to an orientation to our fellow citizens more amenable to a politics of the common good. Meritocracy makes solidarity and the common good harder to imagine and harder to enact politically.
So there are several solutions to this problem. You could either go with the equality of opportunity, which we do now most of the time, is saying everyone has the same or somewhat same opportunity. You could go with the equality of the results. But you propose a third approach, which you call the broad equality of condition. What do you mean by that?
Let me begin by explaining why equality of opportunity, though important, is not sufficient for a just society. It is important, of course, that no one be held back due to prejudice, due to being born into a poor family. So the project of equality of opportunity is morally important, but it's important to recognize that equality of opportunity is a remedial principle. It is not by itself a sufficient principle to bring about a just society, because even if we could one day achieve true equality of opportunity, where everyone began the race at the same starting point, it would still be predictable who would win the race.
Well, but
the
why?
Fastest runners.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but why?
Couldn't you, if you're
really radical, couldn't you say the solution to this whole problem is just to change the circumstances? For example, not have any inheritance anymore. So if you tax inheritance with 100%, then everyone technically has the same chance to start over in life, right? Because you haven't inherited anything from your parents.
Well, you wouldn't have inherited money. And I am in favor of a substantial inheritance tax, but it would not be an adequate solution in itself. although the next generation would not inherit money, they would inherit all kinds of intangible advantages that we see today and that matter as much as money.
You mean education, for example? Or
education, cultural upbringing, the family support for education, for learning. These are forms of inheritance that even the strongest inheritance tax can't address. I think we should do what we can to bring about genuine equality of opportunity. But it's not enough because it still leaves in place the meritocratic hubris, the sense of self-satisfaction and self-sufficiency that we've been discussing. And to deal with that, I think we need to think more broadly about equality. Now, some people say the only alternative to equality of opportunity is an oppressive kind of equality of results where everyone must have the same income and wealth. That's not my argument, and I don't think that's the only alternative to equality of opportunity. What I argue for is a broad democratic equality of condition, which I think means that in the course of our everyday lives, there are class mixing institutions that enable people of different social and economic, racial and ethnic backgrounds to encounter one another in the course of everyday life, to learn to respect one another, to stand on their own two feet. There has to be a broad diffusion of learning and education throughout the society, not provided only in universities, but in the workplace and in forms of learning where people who don't go to university learn trades. Civil society, trade unions, the media need to be arenas for civic education. A broad democratic equality of condition enables everyone in the society to feel that they are recognized, that they are dignified, that they are honored, and that the contributions they make to the common good are recognized. Whether those contributions are in the form of the work they do, the families they raise, or the communities they serve. Another way of putting this is to say that I think we need to shift in our public discourse and political focus from arming people for meritocratic competition toward renewing and affirming the dignity of work. And I think we need a broad public debate about what the dignity of work consists in, because the sense of exclusion that many working people feel today goes beyond a matter of economic inequality. It's a sense that the society no longer honors and respects and recognizes their contributions to the economy and to the common good. So the broad democratic equality of condition would address this. It would ask how we can renew the dignity of work. It would ask how we can diffuse civic education throughout the society. So, and it would create the civic infrastructure for a shared civic life, public places and common spaces that bring people together in the ordinary course of their lives so that there is not the tendency of the affluent to secede from the common spaces and public places that gather people together and remind them that they are citizens sharing in a common project.
That sounds, I have to say, like a wonderful approach, but some people might argue that the unfair system is being upheld and held in place on purpose by the people who benefit from that system and the people who are in charge, so have the power to decide what system we live in. So is there any way you see that this utopian vision that you have could become reality within the next years?
I wouldn't describe it as a utopian vision precisely because it does not require a leveling equality or an equality of income and wealth. I think that it embodies certain ideals of commonality does not make it utopian. And we can look even to our relatively recent past. not for a golden age, not for a vision of utopia, but for a time when economic growth, for example, benefited all classes of society. During the 30 years following the Second World War, there was global economic growth, and that economic growth lifted people in all economic classes. Whereas in the globalization that we've seen in the last 40 years has produced some economic growth, but in a highly skewed way. Almost all of it has gone to the top 20 or 30%. Very little has gone to the bottom half. And so I don't think we need to imagine a utopian scenario to ask how we can reconfigure the economy to lessen the inequalities that recent decades, the decades of neoliberal globalization, have produced. And more than that, how we can affirm the dignity of work rather than allowing all recognition and prestige to flow to professional credentialed elites who look down on those less credentialed than themselves. The very fact that this is a relatively recent development, a development of the last three or four decades, suggests that it need not necessarily be so. It's not an intrinsic feature of capitalism or of the kind of democracy we have today, that representative institutions be dominated by big money, large corporations, that working people have less and less a voice, less and less dignity, less and less social recognition. This is why it's important to see how this has developed really only over the last three or four decades as a result of certain policies that could be otherwise.
So would you say it is necessarily connected to a reform of democracy? Or because I'm still wondering who could change the system if the people in place benefit from that system?
Well, this is always a challenge. There are always those who benefit from the established arrangements. Now, what happened, and here I think it's instructive to recall the argument that was made for the neoliberal or market-driven version of globalization that we've had in recent decades. The argument was this: we will deregulate finance, we will allow offshoring and outsourcing of jobs, we will allow capital and people and goods to flow across national borders. And the economic growth, yes, there will be losers, but the gains to the winners will be sufficient so that we can offset the loss to the losers. This was the basic argument. Problem is, that didn't happen. The inequalities deepened, but the loss to the so-called losers, that was not offset through redistribution or other measures, redistribution of income or of power and voice. And one of the reasons this didn't happen, and this is the fault of center-left parties as well as of center-right parties during this period, the reason it didn't happen is that representative institutions were captured increasingly by those with vested interests in the new arrangements. And so that's what needs to be rethought. It's interesting that mainstream parties of center-left and center-right have been the victims of the backlash against elites, the populist backlash. But the primary victims, the main casualties, have been center-left parties. We see this with the Democratic Party in the United States, the Labor Party in Britain, the Socialist Party in France, the Social Democrats in Germany. And it's worth asking why. I think that center-left parties in particular need to rethink their mission and purpose, to find a way to reconnect with the working class voters who once were their constituency, but who have abandoned them as these parties increasingly became parties of the well-educated, well-credentialed professional classes. So it's true, there are vested interests in the current arrangement, but we need to, if these parties are to reinvigorate themselves, They need to rethink their mission and purpose, move away from the rhetoric of rising, figure out ways to contend with the loss of dignity for work and with the eroded democratic possibilities, and figure out how to rejuvenate civic life. That's the mission that especially center-left parties need to figure out if they're to deal with this.
So basically you're arguing we need to focus more on the common good, what you call the common good. Would you say that the pandemic is helping to start a broader public debate about this notion, the idea of the common good, now that we see, for example, how important public or health workers are?
The pandemic could be the beginning of a broader public debate about the common good. But whether or not it does depends very much on us. It's a matter of political will. The opening is created by the fact that the pandemic has directed our attention to our reliance on the important work being carried out by many workers who are not well paid or well recognized. And so this could be the beginning of a broader debate about what really does count as a valuable or essential contribution to the common good. There's a comment by Martin Luther King in 1968, shortly before he was assassinated, that is brought to mind by this moment. He was in Memphis, Tennessee, speaking to a group of striking sanitation workers shortly before he was assassinated. And he told them this. He said, "The person who picks up our garbage is, in the final analysis, as significant as the physician. For if he doesn't do his job, diseases are rampant. All labor has dignity." This was Martin Luther King. What's striking about that quote, that insight, is that it directs our attention to the question of contribution and the dignity of work. And so a new politics of the common good has to include an emphasis on how can we renew the dignity of work. But we can't answer that question unless we have a broader ethical debate about what really does constitute a contribution, a valuable contribution to the common good, and how can we reconfigure the economy to reflect what truly matters without assuming that the money people make is the metric, the measure of the value of their work or of their true contribution to the common good. That's the broader debate we need, it seems to me.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sandel. Wonderful.